Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history.
I did a podcast with Georgi in Bulgaria and Christopher in Germany. I wanted to get their thoughts on various things that were happening in Europe, and their views also on the Ukraine war and Ukraine. And we ended up chatting about quite a number of different things. So here's the podcast. Are there Georgi and Christopher? It's good to be back chatting to you guys. How are you doing, Georgi?
I'm fine, thank you. Observing the situation in the world, so to say, and I could add, I told you so, but it's not very polite, but it's true. I told you so.
Okay, well, we got a lot to talk about. How are you doing, Christopher?
All is well.
That's good to hear. I want to just chat today a little bit about Europe, as well as, of course, the Ukraine war, which is such an important thing. And either of you guys can just dive in to answer and with your views. So I think the first thing, Christopher, how are things going in Germany?
It depends. Politically, the situation is stressed because we have a coalition of the Social Democrats, the Green Party, and the, yeah, you could call it Liberal Party. And they're not fitting that well together, so there's a lot of trouble in the government. Tensions in the economy, but this is mainly due to outside factors, I would say. Rising prices in oil and gas. Lack of workers. I can give you one example. In the next 10 years, 11.5 million Germans will go into retirement, and there are only 7.5 million of new workers coming from the schools, etc. So, yeah, we have a shrinking workforce, more expensive resources. But it's not the time to panic, so I think we will manage it. And you have these economic problems worldwide. This is a worldwide phenomenon related to COVID and the war in Ukraine. So, yeah, we have some problems. And then there's an energy problem because of the Green Party. They are very prone to these renewable energies, and they shut down our nuclear electric facilities, and now they're shutting down the coal mining as well. And they want, yeah.
Do you guys have nuclear power?
Yeah.
Really? I never knew that. I didn't know that you Germans had. Did you just have nuclear power for electrical? For generating electricity?
Yes, actually, we supposedly had the most advanced and most modern reactors in the world.
Ha! That's excellent to hear. So,
but they shut it down, so don't celebrate too early.
Oh, boy. When did they shut it down? Is it recent?
They shut down the last six of them this year.
Oh my God.
What a bunch of doofuses. You know, all this, pardon me for interrupting, Georgi. You know, it's amazing that they call all this stuff green energy. It's not green. It's not green energy. They're just taking you away from that, which is logical. And nuclear is awesome. Nuclear is the most efficient and cheapest way to generate electricity. But
it is. But don't forget that there's also a political element in it. Because if you have a nuclear energy, you have the centrifuges, the reactors, and so on to, it's called I don't know the English word for it. In German, it's called, you have borderline technology. So you are on the borderline to build a nuclear weapon.
Yeah.
You can very quickly build the atomic bomb. And of course, this is not wanted for Germany. So I'm suspicious that there is a foreign influence that doesn't want Germany to have nuclear power, because this would give us the ability to become a nuclear power in the political sense.
How many years have you had the nuclear power stations in Germany?
60 years.
16. 1 6.
Six. No. 60. We got it right from the beginning. When it started in the 50s and 60s, we started with it. And we created our own types of reactors and so on. And in at the end of the 70s, after the oil crisis, when the French had their nuclear program and built many nuclear plants, there was a plan in Germany to build 50 nuclear plants. And I think at the end we had maybe 15 or 20, I have to look it up. But now they're all gone. And as you can imagine, this led to the consequence that our energy prices went to the sky. And now we have the most expensive electricity in the world.
Well, four times
the American price.
Well, before you say the most expensive electricity in the world, just be aware, hey, you're competing with South Africa. And we got the biggest bunch of fucking dummies on the planet, okay? So don't.
Well, as far as I know, you don't have electricity all the time, so it cannot be that expensive.
No, you don't understand how South Africa works. The less electricity you have, the more they put the prices up. You just don't understand African economics.
Because the revenue has to stay the same, right?
Hey, the revenue's got to keep going up, even if the actual amount of electricity is going down. That's how South Africa works. You don't understand. When blacks work slower and they break more stuff, they charge more. They don't charge less. They charge more. Okay, that's how... I'm not making this shit up, Georgi. This is how it really fucking works. I've put up my own solar panels and my own stuff that I look after. And I got to tell you that I've probably cut the amount of electricity that I use by maybe two-thirds to three-quarters, but my electricity bill remains the same. I'm using a fraction of what I used to use, but my electrical bill is the fucking same. I'm telling you. You guys have no idea how these bloody idiots work over here.
So why is it that way? I'm assuming that they forcefully put a lot of blacks into leading positions in the electricity companies and everything went down, or what happened?
Yeah, and you have no idea how black economics works, okay? Whenever the blacks fail, they turn around and they say they need more money. they never admit that it's their fault or anything like that. There's corruption. There's corruption. The one is busy paying off the other one. Just remember one thing. Africa does not work like a sane Western, country. All the rules that you people know don't work in Africa. It doesn't work like that at all. These bastards can fail more and more, and they will bill you for more. You should see some of the ridiculous junk that happens in South Africa. Things that can't happen in any other country. And I myself, I tell you, my head wants to explode when I think about the opportunities that whites have to get away from these blacks. It's getting so easy. You have no idea. There was something I saw the other day. Pardon me for just, since you've raised the issue of Africa, I'll just rant a little bit just to give you an idea. That we've got our military, our totally useless military, which I'm very happy that it's useless because then it can't kill us. Our totally useless military, I want to give you two or three examples about our totally useless military. The one is there's a tiny, tiny little war going on in a neighboring state, former Portuguese territory, Mozambique. Tiny little war is going on there. There are less than a thousand black Muslims fighting there. They're doing some terrorism against that country, and I'm very happy about it. So at a point, the army of this neighboring state, and the neighboring state's got a population of more than 13 million people, okay? And their army cannot fight less than 1,000 black Muslims, okay? So eventually the blacks in Southern Africa decided most everyone's going to get involved. So South Africa sent 1,500 troops, but the others also sent troops. In total, they sent probably more than 3,000 troops to this neighboring state to fight, I repeat, less than 1,000 blacks who are running around with some AK-47s and knives in the bush, okay? So they sent 1,500 troops from South Africa with a couple of helicopters, maybe two or three helicopters, and then other blacks came in as well. You're looking at about, I can't remember if it was 3,000 or even 5,000 troops from different African countries that are fighting this little group of terrorists. Do you know that the government of South Africa, when they were asked, okay, what is it going to cost to send 1,500 troops to the neighboring state? They were quoting billions of rands, okay, which in US dollars would translate into maybe tens of millions of dollars, maybe even $100 million. I don't know the exact number. But that is what the government says it costs to send a couple of troops there to go and park off there and fight there for, you know, like a year or so. You will not believe the costs of these blacks. Another thing that I saw the other day that I laughed at, I saw South Africa is working with the United Nations, and they got to send some military into the center of Africa for, quotes, peacekeeping. United Nations and peacekeeping forces, that's a bunch of bullshit right there. That's a whole other bunch of bullshit that I don't even want to go into. But listen to this. So one of the newspapers in South Africa ran a story which says, are our soldiers safe? Will our soldiers be safe in another African country? They are basically saying, are our stupid soldiers going to be able to defend themselves against other blacks, another bunch of black terrorists in another country? I thought to myself, you won't hear that. You guys in Europe, you're never going to hear that kind of shit. You know, Georgi, like, nobody's going to say, you know, is the Bulgarian army safe if it goes if it goes into another state? You know, can they defend themselves? So, you know,
I guess if safety is an issue for you, then the military is not the right place, huh?
Well, I'm very happy that the military is useless. The more useless they are, the safer the whites are. That's all I want to tell you. But anyway, so I got us a bit off track there. But regarding Germany and your nuclear stuff, that's very fascinating. I did not know you guys had so much nuclear experience of your own. Even if they've shut the things down, I'm sure at least they've saved the knowledge and the engineering away somewhere. So.
Yeah, kinda. There was a new reactor built in Finland. It's actually the biggest in the world. And the competition was between a Russian company, a German company, Siemens, and a French company. And the Finns decided for the German and French companies to build them. So we can still build them. But one of the downsides of this exit of nuclear energy is that they don't teach nuclear physics at the universities anymore. So in the nearest future, we won't have the engineers and the knowledge. And they're doing this on purpose because the Green Party in Germany, they want to make it impossible to go back to nuclear energy. This was one of the founding ideas of the Green Party where they started with in the 70s. They were always anti-nuclear energy. This is one of their main issues.
These people are lunatics, eh? I'm horrified that they have such power in your country, but yeah.
So I think this is a fifth column. I think this was because in the 70s there was also a huge peace movement, and they were always making protests and demonstrations against. Basically, it's very similar to the situation we have now. So there was this the Soviet mid-range missiles. I think it was called SS-20. And our chancellor at the time, he demanded to get Pershing rockets to counter it. It's also mid-range nuclear rockets. And they were always protesting against our weapons. So they were always protesting for the disarmament of Germany. But they never protested against the Soviet Union or the massive nuclear threat of the Soviet Union. And this is related to this anti-nuclear energy thing. And now we have the same, that we have very weird combinations of people from the left to the right, ex-military guys, famous feminists and so on, and they came together and they protested against NATO, Western imperialism. Of course, they cover this with they're pretending to want peace for Ukraine, but actually they are not protesting against Russia. They are protesting against NATO and against the West. And we had that before. This 40 years ago, it was exactly the same thing. So they went to the American embassy and they protested against these Pershing rockets, but they didn't give a shit about the Soviet rockets aiming at us. And now it's the same. And I think this environmentalism is related to that, because when you have higher energy prices, you have restrictions for the industry, more regulations and so on, you're losing competitiveness to the Chinese and also to the Russians. And the funny thing about this renewable energies is that you have a main problem is that when it's night and there's no wind, you don't have energy, period. You can't fix that. That's physics. So the plan was to build a lot of gas, natural gas power plants. And of course, these would be fueled by Russian gas. So this transition to the renewable energies was very beneficial for the Russians. That's why the Green Party was for these Nord Stream pipelines, because they actually needed that for the green transition. To have a backup, you always need a backup for these renewable energies, and the backup should be powered by natural gas. And now they have a problem that the natural gas isn't there anymore, or it's much more expensive because it's LNG. That's in short the whole problem with the renewable energies and the Green Party.
Okay, well, I've always been very suspicious of any kind of anti-nuclear and quotes peace movements and all that kind of stuff, because in America, I've followed the kinds of things that have happened to the Americans there. When I was in America in 2010, my American host took me to a nuclear power station that had been completely shut down, demolished, everything, etc. And all that was left was you could see all the power lines that had been, that had come out of the place. And I've always looked at communists and Soviet agents and those kinds of people as being among these Greens. Whenever I hear peace movement is normally bullshit, and Green looks like that's green related, and anything anti-CO2, all this other bullshit, all the stuff that gets you away from nuclear and coal and oil. Anything that gets you away from nuclear, coal and oil, there's a whole bunch of bullshit involved in that. So in a nutshell, if I may say, if you Germans were left alone to just do what the hell you wanted to do, you would have lots and lots of nuclear energy, and you'd probably have the cheapest energy in the world. And would you even have needed Russian gas?
The Russian gas, we have it since the end of the 60s. So there was Russian gas before the Nord Stream pipelines. And these Russian pipelines, they were built by a German company, that the pipes were from Mannesmann. And this was done on the Brezhnev back then. But the gas came through Poland and through Ukraine. And what they did was they circumvented Poland and Ukraine. That's why this pipeline was so hated. Because, in case you don't know, the gas still comes through Ukraine. So the Ukrainians are transiting Russian gas to Europe still. Also the Poles. And that was the gas supply of Europe before that. And the German and Russian genius idea was to get the gas directly from Russia to Germany. Huh. And this pissed off the Poles and the Ukrainians, because they get money for the transit of the gas. For example, the Ukrainian gas is free. The Ukrainians, I mean, there was a debate about that 10 years ago. The Russians tried to blackmail the Ukrainians with the gas and so on. But in general, the Ukrainians, they have free gas because they're transiting the Russian gas to Europe.
No way. I never knew that. Wow. So the Ukrainians get free Russian gas.
They get free Russian gas, and they still do. And they get the gas for free because the Russian gas gets through Ukraine and through Poland. And the German idea was to get it to the Baltic Sea, basically from Königsberg or Kaliningrad to Rostock in East Germany. And that's why the pipeline went through the sea and not over land. And this pissed off the Poles and the Ukrainians.
So the Nord Stream was the German Russian plan to have a direct pipeline. Is exactly. That correct?
But okay. I must add a little bit. I think that Kyiv will end this agreement of transit Russian gas this year.
Explain.
So it is an old agreement. It is before the war for quite a long period of time, and it's a more than two sides, multi-party agreement or whatever. So basically,
multilateral.
So if the Ukrainians cancel the deal, they must pay reparations to not only to the Russians, which of course they could ignore, especially in the present situation, even though there is an international court, right? But they must pay reparations to countries like, I don't know, Germany and some other countries. I don't know who is the other side of the deal.
So
when it entered 2024, the chances are that this will end. And I'm looking right now about article written in Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. So it's, you know, whatever. At the end of 2024, a five-year agreement expires, governing one of the oldest and biggest economic links between Russia and Europe. The transit of Russian gas through the territory of Ukraine. Kiev has already said that it will not extend the agreement, and the Russian officials have confirmed no negotiations to that end are under the way. So with either Ukraine or the EU, still, that's not to say that no more Russian gas will ever be shipped via Ukraine. So it's not very clear, but the situation is quite serious, as you can see. Also, they mentioned Bulgaria, Serbia and Hungary. After the appeal of the last 2 years of the war, Russian gas now enters Europe via two routes, well, each of which carries about 40 billion cubic meters of gas per year. The first is via the Turkish Stream pipeline and extension. By the way, the Turk Stream was built with Bulgarian money, interestingly enough, in the Bulgarian part of the pipeline. The Balkan Stream under the Black Sea to Turkey, Bulgaria, Serbia and Hungary. And this is the conspiracy theory here, because this is called Turkish Stream, but actually benefits Russia. So, because we built this part of the road and we didn't receive any money and no benefits, so why the fuck we built it? And the conspiracy theory is most likely is true, knowing that the Prime Minister was secretly operating for the Russian interests. I'm talking about Boyko Borisov, that right now is pretending to be the greatest Euro-NATO fan and so on. So this is about the situation with the gas and with the transportation. It's very complicated. And it's geopolitical, and I don't think that a lot of, especially these Central European countries like Hungary, like Slovakia. By the way, this is the thing that I wanted to mention, that a lot of these, a lot of these Central European countries, they don't have a lot of choices. Well, talking about resources, they must receive resources from somewhere. And because of the complicated situation in the European Union with all the taxes and mitos that supposing we don't pay because part of the EU, they are signing with which is the biggest supporter in Europe of Russia, supposedly Orban, right? They are signing with Russia, and the Slovaks in similar situation. They don't have sea, one to four countries. So, and the Austrians are also the same. So these are like a very simplistic explanation why certain countries are supposedly on the side of the so-called West, but on the other side actually signing with Russia. And there are some countries like Turkey, for example, that supposedly is in NATO, but actually the first opportunity would change sides if this suits their interests. So they are not reliable. Or Israel, by the way, they're the same.
Is Israel in NATO?
No, Israel is not in NATO, but I'm giving example how Turkey, even though he's in Turkey is in Israel, in NATO, but the both countries, Turkey and Israel, are not reliable as an ally of Europe or the West. They have their own interests and they're keeping their relations with Russia, with China, with India, with all these, with even with countries with Iran, which are not friendly towards Israel and towards Turkey, there's some kind of strange diplomatic relations and proxy connections, things like that. So it's much more complicated than a lot of people think. For example, if you are following the situation with the Houthis, the Houthis attack Russian ships, right? Meanwhile, they didn't attack Chinese ships. So, why is that?
I didn't know that.
Why is that? Because Iran, if you know the history, a little bit of history, geopolitics, you know that Persian Empire and Iran back in the time, in 19th century, were the playground of the so-called big game, right? Or the great game between the British Empire and the Russian Empire. And the Iranians, they don't have, they're helping Russia, but they are not particularly fond of really very strong Russia. The same with Turkey. They supposedly are helping Ukraine, but actually also helping the Russians. Supposedly are members of NATO, but actually after their own interests. So at some point, my prediction is that the Turks will change the sides, because this is what they're doing, basically. And for example, there was just an interesting example. There was, if you remember, Christopher, maybe remember that, there was this ship that was sunk, hit by a drone or rocket, we don't know, and that was transporting Iranian drones, and it was a big explosion and a lot of damage, things like that. Supposedly, under the conventions of war, Turkey must close the straits. Why Turks allowed ships, transport ships, but transporting weapons for one of the combating sides, why they allowed that? And this is quite serious, because...
If they did, I mean, as far as I know, many of these ships, they are sailing under the flag of Panama and shit like that. So I don't know if they really control every ship that is passing and get on board and check what is the freight of the ship and so on.
But they know the destination. They know that they're transporting military drones, and they know that it's from Iran, that supposedly is not very friendly towards Turkey too. And they supposedly could prevent this thing.
Maybe the Turk was bribed, or I mean, there's a lot of possibilities for what happened there.
Maybe there is some kind of political game behind the scenes, because they also allow the Ukrainian grain. But the fact is that these type of ships were transporting military drones from Iran. And also there is a thing that the Ukrainians knew that they are transporting drones, and they hit them quite hard there. But the fact is that, for example, Ukraine received some kind of small vessels, military vessels from Britain or Australia, I don't remember, and they were not allowed to pass through the straits. So the Turks... The Turks. I mean, they're playing supposedly in the both camps. Supposedly, yeah, officially,
they're trying to play the big players against each other. But this is a risky. We talked about that before. I think that the Turks are playing a very risky game.
Mm-hmm. But also, there is another thing. Do you remember that the Czech president announced that they found 3 million shells? Out of the European Union. So yeah. From where these shells will come?
I've heard...
Are these old shells? or are these Russian stuff? Because I was
Russian caliber, Soviet caliber.
I was reading that America's got the ability that they are basically running around the world shopping for any old Soviet stuff, and they were even saying that even a guy like Biden has got enough power that he can actually do this without Congress. So what they do is they call it military scrap, and they get these weapons that are, quotes, worthless, and then they get those third world countries to ship it off to Ukraine, or Ukraine to pick it up, and then the Americans pay a bit of money for the, quotes, scrap value. there's a whole bunch of bullshit going on there.
Before we talk about the ammunition issues, can we quickly jump back to the natural gas issue, because I wanted to add an important point. You know, these days everybody, especially in the alternative media, they're all very sure and certain that the Americans blew up the Nord Stream pipeline. Mainly because of an article written by a guy named Seymour Hersh.
A Jew?
Yes. And he wrote this very fancy article with divers and Norwegian Navy and all that stuff. But Jurgi mentioned these long-term bilateral or multilateral contracts. And the same was going on with the Nord Stream pipeline. So I'm not sure who did it. I don't know who did it, but I'm just giving you a motive why the Russians could have done it. So there was a long-term contract between Germany and Russia to deliver the gas, including huge reparations in case that the Russians don't deliver. And the price was fixed for 10 years, I think. So it was cheap, and they couldn't change the price, and they had to deliver the gas. So now the pipeline was destroyed, and this is, from a legal standpoint, this is called a higher force or a natural disaster, destroyed the pipeline. So the Russians got out of this contract and don't need to deliver the gas. And of course they wanted to shut down the gas supply for Germany anyway, to blackmail us. They actually did it. They shut it down, the Nord Stream 1. There were two pipelines, Nord Stream 1, it's the older one, they shut it down, and the Nord Stream 2 actually wasn't working, so that it was planned to get it going in 2023 or so. So it could be a motive for the Russians to destroy this pipeline, to get out of the contract, shut down the gas supply for Germany, and to avoid these reparations. That's what I wanted to add, because everybody is so sure that the Americans did it, but of course there are other players who also had a motive to destroy the pipeline. And now we can go back to artillery ammunition.
I just want to add to that. That is fantastic. I didn't know any of those things, because Seymour Hersh, the Jew, I mean, when I saw that it was a Jew that had written this thing, and everyone was, oh, no, he's so reliable, he's so this, he's so that, I was very skeptical, and I think I did publish some stuff. I'm not sure if there was other stuff from Europe where they were talking about evidence. I'm not sure if it was German or others who had evidence that the Russians, there was something else going on. I personally never bought into the Seymour Hersh story, never. So I'm very skeptical about that. So if you guys have got more on that, and I believe Europe is digging into this.
I have a very good article about it, but I have to look it up. And the guy is a Swedish engineer, a retired engineer. And he is more like, you know, in this MAGA sphere, Trump, this alt-right boomer stuff, I would call it. But he was skeptical about the thing, so he chartered a ship. He bought himself a small U-boat, basically a drone, and hired some drivers and investigated it on its own. And he went down to the pipeline, took pictures of it, and so on. And he basically debunked the story of how they blew it up. I don't remember the details. It's a year ago or so that I read it. But it was very interesting. I'll look it up and then send it to you.
Yes, please. Yes, please. I will happily publish that. Because I when I saw that Seymour Hersh and Jew, I thought, no way. This Jew's on the make. He's telling some story here. And
you know, this was I'm not sure. I'm speculating here. But the guy has credibility because he won the Pulitzer Prize twice.
So, yeah, yes, but a Jew can always lie on the third attempt, okay?
So if you give him a couple of $100,000 or whatever, or he's a secret commie, as many of his people are, and he published the story, this is enormously powerful. Basically, he overwrote everything that was published by any other media. Everybody was talking about Seymour Hersh and that the Americans did it.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, it is very, whoever did it, I don't know, it could be the Ukrainians, even the Poles, maybe the Russians, the USA, I don't know. But it was a very dangerous thing to do. If the Americans did it, they are basically destroying critical infrastructure of a NATO ally. So if this comes to public, very, very bad, which would help the Russians, of course. This thing could make fall NATO apart, right? So
okay, what is
another thing? If the Russians did it, it is a direct attack on NATO infrastructure. So technically, it could trigger Article 5.
Technically, so, but won't trigger anything.
Yeah, of course, we know that, but technically. So whoever did it was a very dangerous thing to do. And I think that from the perspective who has least to lose, who has nothing to lose, who was in a very dangerous situation, could be the Ukrainians. There actually was a German story. There was a German story about Ukrainians hiring a yacht in Poland.
Yes.
With fake documents and so on, and they blew it up. And from the perspective of taking the risk, it's most likely the Ukrainians because they had nothing to lose, right?
Absolutely.
I don't know.
I also remember hearing that story. The one group that I'm sure didn't do it was the Americans. That much I figured out.
the whole thing is very. Because, yeah, it makes sense that Ukrainians, they also found some guy, they telephoned a guy that supposedly was also a member of the Ukrainian military intelligence or something like that, and they telephoned him or something like that. But at the other hand, who the fuck knows? Because if the Russians, for example, they will make it to look like it's Ukrainian, so vice versa.
It depends
how it, especially for the Westerners, who the fuck knows, is it the Russian? The Russians could hire the guys, for example, when the Ukrainians blew up the Crimea bridge for the first time, they hired Russians. So it's basically, do you know the story? Basically, it was the ship was loaded with explosives in my city, in Burgas.
Yeah.
They passed through, was it Armenia or Georgia, the country I mean, in the Caucasus region. And then some couple of Russians loaded the explosives and they blew up the bridge in Crimea. And it was paid by the Ukrainians, obviously. So
I remember that the explosives were on a truck, right? I remember that.
Yeah.
But how did they blow it up? So basically, they drove the truck on the bridge, then they stopped, jumped out, ran away, and then they blew it up.
no fucking
because
idea.
To me it looked like a suicide bomber or something.
My
because it was the truck was driving and then it exploded, if I remember correctly.
My suspicion is that the guys that loaded the truck were not there, and the guy that was driving the truck didn't know what the fuck is going on.
Yeah, okay, I got it.
this is what it is.
Yeah, okay.
But this...
And going back to the pipeline for a second, the main question is, did you watch this stupid Tucker Carlson Putin interview? And he asked him...
I didn't bother, but you tell me, because I've lost...
You didn't watch it. It's good to hear that you didn't waste your time on it. So basically he asked Putin directly, he asked him, not who did it or did you do it. He said, what is the evidence that the CIA did it, right? And Putin didn't answer it. He just said, yeah, well, everybody knows. I don't need to say anything because we already know what happened or something like that. So the question with this pipeline is, so he didn't say the Americans did it or the Ukrainians did it or anything like that. This thing is investigated probably by Germany, by the Swedes, by the Poles, whatever, all the countries at the Baltic Sea. The Germans don't say who did it. The Americans don't say that the Russians did it or the Ukrainians did it. So that nobody says anything about it. The investigations are top secret. We don't know anything. And maybe this is another time that they are protecting the Ukrainians. Because if the Ukrainians did it, and we know, and the Americans know, and the Swedes know, and so on, and they would make it public that the Ukrainians blew up our pipeline, this would bring down the support for Ukraine from the public view. I'm speculating here, but that's the question. I mean, this is Russian property, right? And Russian and German property, so they need to protect it. They need to check it. This is critical infrastructure. So there's surveillance, there are ships, there's everything to protect this pipeline, especially in times of war. And they, first of all, why they weren't able to protect it? They couldn't protect it. And obviously, they are not able to make a proper investigations and to find out who did it. And this is the whole thing is very strange. And 2 years ahead, and we don't know anything, basically. Well, you can read Seymour Hersh, but yeah, that's it. Very strange thing.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Because all that I did here is that NATO, various Germany and other countries were busy investigating. But you're right. Now, no one said a word. No one said said a word. But I will tell you that Tucker Carlson, I've lost so much respect for that guy. I couldn't take him seriously.
Why did you have a respect for him for the first place? I mean, he's
well. I liked some of the stuff that he was putting out that was racial in America when he was on Fox News. I liked it that he was tackling issues like blacks. He even did a thing about, you know, black pilots. People getting killed because the blacks can't fly the planes. So, I mean, that kind of stuff where I was like, yes, yes, that's good. But when he went to go and do the Putin thing, by then I'd seen a little bit of what he'd been doing on Twitter. I was not impressed. And I've lost a lot of respect for his intelligence, and as a journalist, you know, if he's really digging, he could have done a lot better. I'm not impressed at all. For me, the interview with Putin was like as low as you can go. I preferred to go and watch a young Russian guy who actually tore into the interview and told you a whole bunch of stuff about Russia and Ukraine. Straight off, that to me was much better.
My view is that the interview actually was the interview was specifically designed and by Putin and his crew to to sound as it sound and to hit the. It was not a striking interview, but this was the idea of the interview. So basically, he referred to he is talking history. Americans are the most people that were watching this interview. They don't know jack shit about history. He present himself as a very because he asked him about being seeing himself as a religious leader or sent by God or something like that, which again, if you remember, we made the show 2 years ago before the war. I told you that it's very weird rumors about the religious and occult beliefs behind the ideologies of Kreml or Kremlin. They had these strange ideas. Putin, he see himself as the new Tsar, a new emperor, which is a God chosen. And there was a bunch of strange messianic stuff around that. But the answer of Putin was very, very average. He said, no, I don't see myself like that, blah, blah, blah. So basically the idea was to calm down the Americans that don't know jack shit of history, but the things that Putin is saying would sound to them kind of reasonable, which is not true. It's like Bulgaria claiming the whole Balkan Peninsula because 1,000 years ago we ruled all these areas. And not to mention that the Kievan Rus is not a direct forefather of Moscow, whatever, it doesn't matter. So the second thing is his talk about Poland and Germany. So he twisted the history in such a way that he could win the support of German conservatives like AfD, if you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he talk all this bullshit about Ukraine because he's also in the election year, even though election is quite laughable, but he must repeat the talking points for his own election. So basically he was hitting the three main groups that are important for him: the Americans, the Germans, and he was flexing on the Poles, because at some point they'll become a target for the expanding Russian Empire if they're not stopping Ukraine, of course. And he's talking the talking points for his own electorate, so to say. So basically this was the idea, to calm down the Americans, because there were debate in the American Senate again for the help in Ukraine, to calm them down, to say I'm reasonable, blah 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 blah. And the sleeping American said, is that all? Nothing will happen, which is not true.
I think we're overestimating the possibilities and abilities of Tucker Carlson as a journalist. So, if you want to have an interview with Vladimir Putin, then you send a request to the Kremlin and they will ask you, okay, you can get the interview, but send us a catalog of the questions you will ask before the interview. And you will send them your questions. They will say, okay, this yes, this no, you can ask this, you can't ask this. Are you interested? Yes or no? So then Tucker Carlson goes there. The second thing is, this is targeting a specific audience. So it's these anti-Ukraine, pro-Trump, isolationist Americans. And this is specially made for them. Because no pro-Ukraine like guys like you and me, we won't listen to this interview and change our mind. Never. And so this is made for a specific audience, and that's what we got. So nothing special. I don't know why everybody is talking about it. It was very foreseeable what will happen and what it will be like. Yeah, and what you said, he referred to history. You know, what's very interesting about it is that it showed how he thinks what is a nation and what is a state. Basically, the older it is, the more right you have to the land. And what the people want and what the public of this nation wants doesn't matter. So if the Ukrainians make the Maidan and they said we want to be part of Europe and we feel like Europeans, and no, doesn't matter. Because there was the Rurik and blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, when there was this vote in Crimea to join the Russian Union, then the public opinion matters and not history.
Of course, of course, of course.
So he just picks what he wants. And if you think about it, if you go by that idea of what is a nation, what is a country, then the Americans have to put down their flag, put down put up the Union Jack, and swear an oath to King Charles. Because he has the older claims, the older rights of America. I can give you 1,000 other examples, especially in Europe, it's very complicated. But yeah, that's basically what he said. Who has the oldest claims can take it, and what the people want, and it doesn't matter.
But this means that Ukraine must expand, because in my understanding, if Kiev and Rus was not only Ukraine, but also Belarus, but the Ukrainians that I know, they always talk about the Belarus. Oh, yeah, the closest to us are Belarusians, not the Russians. And the thing that they are called Russians is whole another thing, because Russia, it's...
I remember Zelensky even saying that the Poles are closest to them.
Well, this is for political reasons.
Of course.
I remember private sector back in 2014 when I communicated, they were very skeptical about the Poles, and maybe they are right. Maybe they are right. I mean,
I will not comment on the Poles.
but the thing is that Poland theoretically have invested interest, if they were honest, invested interest to help Ukraine to keep the Russians at bay. But it looks like they, in Poland, this is very surprising for me, in Poland there are groups of people that want the Russians to win, which is amazing.
That's crazy.
This is suicidal.
No. This is not surprising to you. I mean, you live in a former Warsaw Pact, Soviet-controlled country, and you know that there are these old Soviet communist networks, and the officials of the time are still there. There's connections to Moscow. Unfortunately, this is the case with all these former Soviet-occupied European countries.
Guys, I have two questions that I want to throw your way. The first one is that I saw an article from RT, the Putin's propaganda people.
And this was banned in Germany, by the way. They cried out a lot.
Really? RT has been banned in Germany?
Banned in Germany, not available anymore.
And Bulgaria.
Really?
Well, yeah.
Well, they are nothing more than Russian propaganda. That's what I've figured out. So anyway, but I came across an article where Putin was talking about the denazification of those little white states there in the Baltic. He was saying that these people are engaging in fascism and stuff like that. And I was quite horrified by that. And I thought, well, there is something right out of the horse's mouth where he seems to be basically threatening small white European nations. Any thoughts on that?
Okay, for the liberals, like my clients, you know, the German family that I mentioned, I had these debates with them. They're kind of Western-grown Russophiles, right? Because hippies and all the shit, you know, I told to Christopher some of my clients, German family, that were protesting against the war in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, why
in
you...
In front of the U.S. embassy.
Yeah, why you not protesting in Russia? What will happen if you protest in Russia? Well, the woman, the wife that was Spanish, was more honest than the Georg. And he said, most likely we'll be arrested. So you're not protesting in the right place, I think. But whatever. So contrary to... The Russians are using double speak. They are talking about denazification. So for these Western grown people that are in their 50s, 60s, whatever, these children of hippies and whatever, the worst things ever that excuse any kind of cruelty, dehumanization against the victims is to be called Nazis, right? But what the Russians mean by denazification is totally different. Denazification means in their language the destruction of the nations of these people.
Yeah.
Right? And this is the thing that these Western lips, they don't understand. They are always talking about the kids, the peace, her peace, blah, blah, blah. But they are not understanding the right of to struggle, to fight for your own existence, for the right of these smaller nations to have their own agency, to defend their own culture, languages, things like that. The peace. Well,
I think from a Russian perspective, what makes you a Nazi? First thing, what you just said is that you are a nationalist, not even a radical nationalist, that you believe that you belong to your own nation and that you have some kind of patriotism and that you identify as a Latvian or whatever. And the second thing is that what makes you a Nazi is if you're anti-Russian. Of course, this is related, right? If you are Ukrainian nationalist, you're anti-Russian because you don't want to be part of the Muscovite Empire. And the third thing is, which is rarely mentioned, I think it's a little bit of a racial issue. It has a lot to do with this identifying as Slavic, whatever that means, right? And the enemy is always some kind of Germanic type of people. Right, that's the British, the Crimean War, and then it's the Americans and the Cold War, which are predominantly Germanic, you could say, or were at the time, not anymore. And then you have the Second World War. So it's also, there's an underlying racial thing, which they would never admit publicly, but I think this is the case. So you're a nationalist, you're anti-Russian, and maybe the worst thing which tops everything is that you're all three of it and that you're also from a Germanic country. That's what I think. And for them, it's not like, you know, you're like the swastika and you're raising the arm and having a picture of Hitler in your living room or whatever. It's very simple for them.
Do you remember that in 2020 the Russians were talking about Nazis in Kazakhstan?
Kazakhstan?
Yes, Nazis there. Yeah. They're some kind of Central Asian supremacist, I suppose, that were threatening the Russians there, and they were speaking about the Nazis in Kazakhstan. If you remember, just before the war, there was a strange incursion in Kazakhstan. And what happened is that the Russians entered and ran away after 2 or 3 days. And they ran away because the Chinese said no.
Yeah, that's a growing conflict, which many people don't have on the screen, is that the battle over Central Asia between the Russians and the Chinese for dominance in Central Asia has already begun. But nobody's talking about it because the Ukraine and other stuff is in the focus now. But yeah, this will be very interesting, what will happen in Central Asia.
What will happen in Central Asia? The Americans are trying to prolong the regime of Putin and actually helping the Russians because they are afraid that eventually the Chinese will take these ones in the far east of Russia and they will become extremely powerful. This is the fear of the Americans, and that's why they're sacrificing Europe, Ukraine and Europe as extension for the Russians. This is what the Americans are doing.
I think that the Chinese might take it. I mean, they have this Silk Road Initiative, and they will build the empire the American way. So formally, these countries will stay independent, but they will become so dependent on the Chinese economy and trade and so on that the Chinese will have control there. And I don't see how the Russians can control this, what they can do. I mean, they don't need natural resources because they have a lot of them in Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, where they are very rich in natural resources and the industrial bases in China. So what can the Russians do about it? And their military is too weak to fight on different spots at the same time. So I think it's already a win for the Chinese there.
I am not sure about the strength of the Russians. Maybe right now they are stronger than in the beginning of the war, strangely. Not stronger like numbers of technologies, maybe stronger as a military experience and organization. They're improving.
And preparedness, I would say. Yeah.
They're improving. And I'm afraid that the European armies, they are kind of not ready. And actually what I would do if I was on the head of NATO or America or something that some country that actually had the resources, which is America, the resources, the military resources to change the situation in Ukraine. And I was honest. This is a lot of if you think about it. I would send military specialists to study how the Ukrainians are fighting, but not to train them, but to study.
No, you think they are not doing this? Of course they are doing this.
Maybe they are doing that, but I'm kind of, because a lot of the things that Ukrainians are doing under the surveillance of the Americans, and what the Ukrainian guys that I've listened said that a lot of the NATO trainers, they don't realize what is the situation on the battlefield, which means that they're lacking the experience and the connections with what the Ukrainians are doing. And for example, this is very, for example, the whole thing with the minefields, the guys most likely German that were training the Ukrainians with the Leopard tanks will say, oh, okay, what about the minefields? Okay, you will bypass the minefields and say, well, we cannot bypass the minefields. They're everywhere. So they don't understand the scale of the conflict and how massive is the war. So basically, I will tell you what is the problem of Ukraine right now, what the things are going, and I have some communication with Ukrainians, young guys. So basically, they are guys that are on the front line, that are volunteers. The young guys that I'm talking about are volunteers. The other young guys that are not on the front line, they are not on the front line because they are not mobilized. And now the discussion in the Ukrainian society is to lower the age of mobilization, because right now is something like 27, to lower it to 25. So these guys that are like 18, 19, 20, 21 to 27, they are not on the front line if they don't want to be on the front line. So the average age of the infantry was the infantryman on Ukrainian side is 43, I believe.
Wow.
So
that's quite old.
They're sending there two types of guys. First, the volunteers. They suffered quite serious casualties. I don't know how many. I'm not some kind of Nostradamus or something, but my suggestion is at least 100,000 guys volunteered, maybe more. They had quite a high morale. We are talking about our guys, like nationalists, ultra-nationalists, national socialists, call it as you want. At least 100,000, maybe more, not sure. Then you have professional military that fought. They suffered also quite serious casualties. And then you have these mobilized elderly guys. And then you have reserve of young guys that must be on the battlefield, in my vision, if I had the ability to being the president, I must send these young guys. But they don't sending the young guys because it's a political decision. This is democracy. And the guy want to be reelected maybe eventually at some point. And from a social perspective, maybe this is also a very hard choice because these are young guys, they're out of school, in the first year in the university, must earn money for the economy, starting family, things like that. So they're not sending on the battlefield. So, and going back to the number, if I was suffering 1 million, this is end of everything, but they wouldn't talk about if I'm going to mobilize the 27 years old or the 25 years old. They would send everything on the battlefield. And this is not going on. So these numbers, everything is bullshit. This is just some kind of Russian agent provocateur that is masking himself or herself as a American from Ukraine or something like that and talking bullshit. Now,
I remember talking to a Norwegian guy. It was middle of 2022, so the war was going like 3-4 months, and he told me that he had read somewhere that the Ukrainians already lost 200,000 men. After 2 months. So this propaganda is going on for a long time, that they are dying en masse and that it's all useless and so on.
No. When I was for 1 day in Ukraine with the family that I was trying to help, 1 day in Lviv, there was a full of young guys, and a lot of people don't like that. A lot of young guys, this was 2022, so it was relatively almost in the beginning, let's say. Not exactly, but almost in the beginning. And there were full of young guys on the restaurants, in the cafes, things like that. Now, Lviv is on the border, let's say, the western border, but they are not lacking men. They are lacking, there are a lot of guys that are deserting. This is a problem. Maybe 15,000, some people said 40,000 men, but they still have guys to fight. This is not a problem. The problem is equipment and organization. And the third problem is that nobody is talking about. Russian agents deeply infiltrated in the government. They have a problem with organization. Yesterday I was listening to Butuzov. Butuzov is a Ukrainian military blogger. So he is very close with the military and he is criticizing Zelensky. And he presented a lot of his early speeches before the war, how they were calmed down the Ukrainian population because Zelensky is a comedian, Jew comedian. And he was talking kind of bullshit, like literally 1 month before the aggression, they said, oh no, the Russians won't attack, blah, 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 blah. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian military, their intelligence and the American intelligence were reporting every day that the Russians will attack. And I remember in a lot of these supposedly NS conservative circles, they were supporting the Russians, like, oh, the America is talking bullshit, blah, blah. And I said, the pictures, the satellite pictures are quite obvious. They had a lot of trains with equipment, a lot of oil, and they're preparing for something. this is not just sitting there on the border for 2 months or 3 months and doing nothing, like military games or whatever.
Yeah, but the Russians, they fooled the West. Do you remember at that particular time, the whole talking was about NATO expansion, and Putin sent this list to the West with all his demands of retreating NATO troops from the Eastern European countries. So he was doing all this fakery about NATO expansion, and he used this to camouflage his attack. And many analyzers in the West said, oh, he's just doing this to put up pressure on NATO and to get a better position in these negotiations and so on. So it was a trickery, and the Russians fooled us. And I remember when Biden said that the Americans should leave Ukraine and that the Russians are preparing for an attack, the alternative media was shouting, oh, Biden is a warmonger, he's scaring the people, and blah, blah, blah. I remember that very well. The Americans were actually, if I remember correctly, they were the first who said they will attack.
They will attack, but what the Americans did to prevent the attack?
Nothing. A little bit, let's say, a little bit. They gave them a little bit of training and some stingers and javelins and stuff like that. I don't know. I mean, we can speculate, were they a little bit scared about the escalation of the whole thing? Or maybe they had written off, that this is my theory, that they had written off Ukraine already. I remember this military advisor, and he said, they will only last for 3 days and then the whole thing will be over.
Yes,
and our Minister of Economy here in Germany said the same thing. We're sorry, this is very bad, but I don't think they will last longer than 3 years. This thing is already over. And I think the resistance that the Ukraine put up put pressure on the Western countries to support them. But this wasn't the plan from the beginning.
I totally agree with you, because people were saying that this is over for Ukraine. Nothing's gonna, they're not gonna survive. I was following it myself every single day, almost by the hour. And the fact that the Ukrainians were surviving, especially at Kyiv, because I was watching, and they were going to be it was reckoned to be just a matter of days, and the Russians are going to have Kyiv. And in reality, the whole thing started bogging down. And, you know, I think everyone was amazed when they survived even the first week.
And although Zelensky is a very suspicious figure, we can go deeper into that, but we have to give him that he started a very successful media campaign. With all the things, you know, staying in Kyiv, making videos at night and saying, I need ammunition, I don't need a taxi, when the Americans tried to get him out there. And he really gained a lot of support for Ukraine, to be honest. We are not so sure what his initial position was about this war. There are many Ukrainians who are very suspicious about him and don't like him at all. And I think he also was a little bit pressured into the position he has now.
Yeah. The Reds, remember that. Do you remember last year when this American idiot disclosed, or I must say, took the secret documents for Ukraine?
Oh, this young boy.
Yeah, this moron.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah. And do you remember what was written in the documents? That actually CIA was following Zelensky. They were looking into Zelensky. So why the fuck is that? And answer...
It's a standard procedure.
It's a standard procedure, but maybe they also think that he's suspicious.
Yes. I remember watching this video of a guy. He was in the Ukrainian Duma, the parliament. And he was at the beginning he was in this pro-Russian fraction, but he switched sides and is now pro-Ukrainian. And it's been a while ago that I watched it, but basically he said that Zelensky wanted to surrender, and he was basically holding back the military and slowing everything down.
Yeah.
And then Solushny, the leader of the military, on its own, without the knowledge and the agreement of Zelensky, decided to counterattack.
Oh, and, wow, that's interesting.
And so the military basically pushed forward and attacked the Russians, and then Zelensky had no choice anymore. And maybe, I mean, he, in the beginning he was in these bunkers and so on, and maybe, I don't know, I'm speculating, that there were some Ukrainian nationalists and they told him, okay, my friend, you have option A and option B. Option A is you support our cause, option B you disappear. Hmm? And it's easy to make him disappear. That he could be poisoned by Russians or something, right? So they had him under control. I'm speculating.
You know, there's a particular Ukrainian whose channel I follow from time to time. He's a pilot, and he puts out some pretty good news, pretty interesting, well thought out news. And he, you know, recently Zelensky was replaced, and he said that in Ukraine, Zelensky is extremely popular. And he even said that Zelensky is so popular that he could become the president. Mm-hmm. And that surprised me. So you know, that adds to your story that maybe you're quite right that Zelensky was the guy who turned the tables, and regardless of what the Jew Zelensky said. That's very interesting.
Guys, there was also other generals like General Krivonos and some other guys. One of the generals actually died in very suspicious circumstances with a helicopter crash. And he was responsible for the counterattacks. And I remember this was like a breaking turning point of the war when Azov, because in the first few hours of the attack, there was these Russian channels, they were overwhelming us with bullshit, like Azov surrendered, they were massacred, things like that, private sector were massacred, things like that. So I said, this is impossible. I mean, these guys are very well trained, they're in defensive positions, they cannot be overrun for basically a couple of hours. Some serious shit must happen. And some guys say, oh, the Russians are using whatever, some bullshit, like tactical nukes or something like that. I said, you cannot use tactical. Can you think what will happen if the Russians are using tactical nukes? The Americans maybe wouldn't respond, but the Chinese will make a lot of problems with that. So anyway, in the third, or maybe it was the fifth hour of the war, one of the guys from Azov made a video, and they were with their tanks. They said, don't worry, we're holding positions. The Russians are suffering heavy casualties. And in the back, there was a multiple destroyed tanks, obviously Russians, and say we have orders from the high command to counterattack, and we are crushing them. So I said, well, this guy really is from Azov. I mean, I know him from their older videos. I know him like a visual, and he's alive. They're holding position, so something is going on right there. So. And later I've understood that Zelensky was under the, they directly commanded these national units. Meanwhile, the president was not adequate. He's either totally incompetent, especially in the beginning, or maybe it was agent. Let's give them benefit of a doubt that he was not very competent, because he's basically civilian representative, artist or actor or whatever, Jew, not very physical, obviously. So it was very shocking for him. Maybe this was the problem. But my suspicion is that there are a lot of factors behind the scenes that we don't see.
Maybe this was even one of the triggers for Putin, that he thought, okay, Ukraine is in a weak position. They have a weak leadership now, because I think we would consider Poroshenko as more capable to handle the situation. Maybe this was one of the triggers. What you just said is that I think this is a very interesting question. You know, I like spies and intelligence agencies and so on. And do you remember that they had a department of the GRU who had a budget of $5 billion to bribe and infiltrate the Ukrainians? And actually, the money was stolen, and the head of this department disappeared. That was the story. So I was very amazed, because, as you can imagine, it was part of the Soviet Union for a long time. So you will have a lot of pro-Russian officers and guys in the military, intelligence, bureaucrats, so on. And I was very astonished that the bribing and the infiltration and so on, so the preparation for the war went so bad for the Russians. Or the other point would be that the cleaning that the Ukrainians did after 2014, they did a lot of cleaning in Ukraine, worked out very well. Because I wasn't questioning the capability of them to fight, or the weaponry or the military. But I was questioning the loyalty of the people to Ukraine. And I was quite surprised how they managed to do that.
Chris, are you saying by cleaning, are you saying that they got rid of traitors and spies?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they not even that. They started to, you know, that the Russians cried out that the Russian language was banned, and
yes,
Russian books
yes.
were banned, yeah. and monuments were teared down, and this was a whole process of de-Russification, you could say. But this went further to military people, to bureaucrats and politicians and so on. And luckily, they had 8 years time for that, and they must have been done that quite well, because if they didn't have done that, the resistance would be impossible, because everything was infiltrated, as you can imagine.
Okay, very good points. Guys,
which reminds me,
guys,
which reminds
guys,
me that
just hold just on, to, just hold on. We've got about a half an hour left, and I just want to get certain questions in for you guys before we end today. So I just want to hit on some specific points and hear your views. One question that I've got is, in World War II, the Germans and the Ukraine, what is the relationship between the Germans and the Ukraine? Because the thing that I've picked up from people like Ben Claassen, and also from Ernst Zundel's wife, Ernst Zundel in Canada, his wife was Ukrainian, Ben Claassen was Ukrainian as well, is there seem to be quite a lot of Germans in various parts of Russia. But I have a very specific thing I'd like to ask you guys. When the Germans went into Russia in World War II with Operation Barbarossa, and the Ukrainians loved the Wehrmacht coming there, and I think there was even a Ukrainian SS. What did the Germans do? My understanding is that some part of this operation also included some kind of let's call it colonization or Germans being moved into Russia or something. Can you tell me whether the things that Hitler and the Germans did in World War II, whether any of that could have improved the ties and links between Ukraine and Europe and Ukraine and Germany, and whether any of that has played a role in this rise of these Ukrainians who are anti-Russian? I'd like your thoughts on that. And maybe what I'll add into this, I want to add something into this, because I don't know that much, I don't know much about Russian history. I know little bits and pieces. I was quite surprised, believe it or not, I only discovered this a little while ago, is that I didn't know that Finland had been part of Sweden, and that as a result of Napoleon striking a deal in 1811 with the Russians, that is how the Russians grabbed hold of what is now Finland. And what I found interesting was that I didn't know that the Finns broke away from the Russians just before or just after the Bolshevik Revolution. And the Finns broke away from the Russians and they fought war against Russia and they wanted nothing to do with Russia. So it surprised me that the Finns had lived under Russian rule for over a century. And then later it's like, let's call it the European DNA kicks in and they want nothing to do with Russia. So let me end off by saying this, that it is to me as if, oh yes, there was something the CIA said when this Ukraine war started. There were some people in the CIA who said that in the future, Russia could break up. And so I'm kind of wondering if this Finland, Ukraine stuff, whether are we seeing the beginning of, let's call it, the white Russians breaking away from Russia? Is it possible that the western parts of Russia could end up leaving Russia and joining NATO in Europe? So I leave it to you guys. Your thoughts, please.
Okay, I can start and I'll try to keep it short. So the case with Operation Barbarossa and the invasion of the Soviet Union. There are many people who think that the Germans are some kind of angels. This is not true. And then there's the other fraction who think that they were the devil, which is also not true. So there were three reasons why we attacked the Soviet Union. The first reason was because we couldn't invade England, we couldn't defeat Britain, and the British wouldn't stop the war, because they were counting on the Soviet Union. So the idea was, if we knock out the Soviet Union as a continental power, the British would come to reason and would make a deal with Germany. That was number one. Number two, of course, it was an ideological thing, right? The fight against the communism or Bolshevism and to get rid of communism. Number three, it was imperialism. They tried to conquer Lebensraum, living space in the East. That is not even a thing that came out of the mind of Hitler. It is quite older. They tried this in World War I and II. And then there was this blockade after World War I where 1 million Germans starved to death. And that's why Hitler came to the conclusion that we need more space to for farming and more land so that we can become sustainable, because at the time we were 80 million people and the farming was not so sophisticated, so we couldn't feed ourselves, and we were always in a position that everybody could blackmail us because they could starve us to death. So they wanted more land, and Ukraine, as you know, is very fertile soil. So that were the reasons why they attacked it. Then when they entered Ukraine, of course, the Ukrainians were quite happy because they didn't like Stalin. Remember, the Holodomor happened in 1933, so 9 years before the, or 8 years before the invasion. So they didn't like Stalin, they didn't like communism, they didn't like to be under the control of Moscow, and they were happy. And the Ukrainians, the Germans did some things they like and some things they didn't like. For example, there was no restitution of the land. So maybe from a perspective of fraternization of the population, you know, there was this collectivized land, this so-called kolchoze in Russia. And the Germans did not change that. So the Ukrainians were hoping that they would de-collectivize the land and give it back to the farmers and so on. But you always have to consider we're in war, in wartime. So it was not so easy to do. And there were many Ukrainians in support of the Germans. But you also have to remember that many Ukrainians were fought in the Red Army, mainly forcefully. Millions of Ukrainians died. And actually, Ukraine was the main battlefield of the Eastern campaign. There were enormous battles in Kiev, in the Krim, and it went back and forth and encirclements and millions of POWs and enormous destruction. Another thing is that the Gauleiter, this is something you could call it, the governor of Ukraine, was a guy named Koch.
Koch, yeah.
And he was not a very good person. He was corrupt, and he was not treating the Ukrainians very well. And this was known in the Nazi party, and many people talked to Hitler about it and tried to get rid of him. But Hitler had this total loyalty. This Koch guy was an old member of the party, and they knew each other for a long time. And so he didn't get rid of him. He was actually living in a castle and collecting art and stuff like that. Very, very corrupt. But he died in a Polish prison in the 50s, I think. There are many perspectives on that. And I think today, why the Ukrainians support Bandera and like the Wehrmacht is because it's simplified for them. It's like the anti-Moscow, anti-Soviet Union, anti-Russian force, you know. They kicked ass of the Russians, and that's why they like the Germans, and they oversee the maybe things you could call didn't went so well. So I will keep it there. There are so many details to talk about.
I will add a little bit about the situation in Ukraine and Second World War. So basically, I'm coming from... So the whole propaganda of the West and the East is that the Germany would genocide the subhuman Slavs. And by Slavs, a lot of people, what they understand by Slav right now, the Germans didn't understand it back in the time. The direct enemies of the Third Reich, if I say, are these people that were neighboring. They're not even all of them, like the Poles, and maybe the Czechs, but the Czechs, they were in a special status in the Third Reich. They were protectorate, if I remember correctly.
Yes, yes.
And they basically were not mobilized in the army. They were making money, working in the industry. And you have the Slovaks that were plus minus in the same condition. They were basically independent country because of the Germany separated from Czechoslovakia, which, by the way, it was artificial creation. Czechoslovakia was artificial creation. Then you have the Croats that were allied, Bulgarians were allied, Romanians were allied with Germany. Then you have the Russians in Belarus. Belarus also, there was a lot of partisan activities, a lot of Russian soldiers or whatever, Jewish commissars and whatever were provocating these atrocities against the German officers and wounded soldiers and things like that. The Germans were responding in measure, I would assume. Let's take in mind that Stalin didn't sign any convention for rights of the captured soldiers, that he used slave labor and all kinds of quite dirty tactics. So I don't know why the Germans judged for their treatment of the Russian prisoners of war. There was no convention that is mutual between Russia and the rest of the world.
No. The Germans, I have a very good book of a German professor about it, and they treated the Russian prisoners according to the Geneva Convention.
Big mistake.
They did, but the problem was that they made so many prisoners. They captured so many troops. They were like millions in the first month of the war, yeah, if you remember. And they were just not able to house them or to feed them. They tried to, but it was impossible. So many of them froze to death or starved. But this was not done on purpose. This is a historical fact. This was not done on purpose.
But partisans and...
And on the other hand, the Russians even, they bombed because... The Soviet Union was the only country in the world where being captured by the enemy was treated as a crime. That was Soviet doctrine. Yeah, it was. If you were captured as a Russian, this was a crime, and even your family could be punished for that. That's why they fought so relentless. So there's a lot of things to say about how the Red Army was pushed to fight that relentless. But I remember reading that they had the Germans had POW camps in Russia. It basically was open space with a fence around it. And the Russian Air Force came and bombed them.
Bombed their own people.
They bombed their own POWs because it was a crime to surrender to the Germans. Punished by death.
Crazy. Yes, but that makes sense because there are those what are those teams that the Russians also put behind their troops, the guys with the machine guns, where
NKVD, they were called commissars, yeah,
where they machine gun their own guys if they retreat.
Yeah.
And there's another interesting fact. I don't know if this is known to you guys. There was a order by Stalin. I don't remember the number of the order. It was something like order 140, whatever. I can look it up. And it was called, in German, we call it Fackelmannbefehl. So it would be like the torchman order.
Yes.
So what the Russians did was they put on German uniforms, went into their own villages, raped the women, burned the houses, basically terrorized them, to push the Soviet population into an anti-German position. So what happened there, this is just one example. It's complicated, and many things are unknown for the usual Western population.
Yes, I'm aware of the Torchman Order, of the Russians breaking the rules of war and putting on German uniforms and engaging in all kinds of atrocities and blaming it on the Germans. Yes, yes. They broke so many rules of war, it's crazy. It's crazy.
But also, let's continue. So basically, about Ukrainians... they are Ukrainians, but basically Himmler had a quite good opinion about Ukrainians. Of course, he tried to present them through his racial view that they're descendants of the Varangians, of the Vikings and the Goths, even more Germanic population, which is, let's say, exaggerated. Maybe there is some truth in some areas about that, but generally it's exaggerated, to say at least. Hitler, I believe, also said some good things about Ukrainians. Also, Skurzeny said quite a lot. He was writing with a lot of respect about the Ukrainians. About Koch, I've read a theory, this could be a wishful thinking, that he was a Soviet agent. Even Skurzeny was a fan of this theory. He said, supposedly he died in a Polish prison. Supposedly. He was not sure about that, but
interesting, yeah.
He claimed that actually the efforts of Koch to sabotage the peaceful living of the Ukrainians actually throwed a lot of problems for the German troops, and that there were a lot of Ukrainian. Skurzeny said that instead of working with Ukrainian nationalists as Bandera, he mentioned Bandera was sent to prison because of the claims of the Polish authorities. Most likely he meant the Polish authorities of the puppet government of Poland or something like that. I don't know the details, but most likely because the Ukrainians were not very big fans of the Poles back then, especially the group of Bandera. There were even a genocide of Polish Poles.
But yeah, this went vice versa. I mean, there was
of course.
Ukrainians on the Poles and vice versa. Yeah.
Of course. This is Europe. I mean, this is going on every day, but or at least in the past. But the Bandera was not. At first, he was not supported by the Reich. I believe in the end of the war, he started to receive some support. But most importantly, that this UPA, Ukrainian Partisan Army, Ukrainian Partisan Army, they were active in the 50s and in the 60s in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
And while Skurzeny was still alive, which means in the 70s, he mentioned that the Ukrainians are still fighting and sabotaging the factories in Ukraine and the Soviet Union. So these guys were active even during the Stalin's regime, and he even formed a secret army, secret police to deal with them, and they were fighting well. But they had their own ideas for Ukraine, so they were not 100% on the German side because of the same problems that we mentioned. Germany needed the resources of Ukraine. This is in the First World War. There was a very good agreement, Brest-Litovsk, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
That was signed by the German Empire, the Austro-Hungary, Turkey and Bulgaria from one side, and the Bolsheviks from another. The Bolsheviks signed capitulation, basically. And the Ukrainian state was created, but it was a puppet state. And Germany wanted to receive food, which was extremely important because we were under blockade, and resources from Ukraine. So if you're Ukrainian and living at that point in Ukraine during the First World War, in the Second World War, the foreign armies are kind of, you know, as a nationalist, we must also understand their position. I mean,
of course.
Yeah. Coming, the foreign armies coming and taking the wheat and the material from your land is kind of shit. So but if has to be honest, Western Ukraine is much closer to Europe, including architecturally, culturally, and everything else. They even have a significant amount of Catholics, let's say. than Eastern Ukraine.
I think maybe the issue is that the people think, okay, the Germans, they prepared for this war, and it was like a huge conspiracy, and they had a plan for everything. Mm-hmm. They had a plan what to do with Belarus, what to do with Ukraine, what to do with this region, what we're doing there. No, they hadn't. It was rather chaotic, and they were, in many cases, they were not acting. They were reacting to the situation. And this is kind of wishful thinking, right? You go into Ukraine and you make fraternization and you make them friends, and then you arm them, and then you send them against the Red Army. But can you trust them? Who's an agent? Who's not? Is this a Russian fakery? Is this a Russian operation? Will they turn against you? You have them in your back and on your side, they will turn against you. Or they will turn against you because, as you said, they have all nationalist ideas and they don't want you there. They don't want the Soviets there, but they also don't want the Germans there, and they want to be their own independent country, and so on. So this is very complicated, and you cannot just go there and give them guns and let them do whatever they want. How you know that you can trust them? You don't.
But now you guys are making me wonder. You're saying that there were Ukrainians already fighting in the time of the Soviet Union after World War II.
Oh yeah, even in the 20s and 30s, they basically fought from the moment that the Soviet Union was established. They fought against them.
Oh, are you serious? They fought against the Soviet Union from the beginning.
Now,
that's interesting. That's all interesting. That is interesting. So they obviously hated that Jewish Bolshevik setup in the same way that the Finns just got the hell out of it at the first chance they got.
No, they hated the Jewish Bolshevik setup more than the Finns, because they suffered tremendously. Finns had the luck to resist more or less successfully the invasion of the Soviets, and they split up before the Bolshevik Revolution. There was a short civil war in Finland after they separated from the Russian Empire between the Finnish Bolsheviks and, let's say, nationalist forces. And thankfully for the Finns, the nationalists won. And about the Ukrainians, I remember, was it Skurtseni or was it, who was the general that took Kiev? He wrote in his German general.
It was not Manstein, right?
I don't remember, but I remember that basically the German Kiev, troops.
Guderian played a big role in Kiev.
So, I don't remember exactly, but he wrote in his diaries that basically the German troops entered and saved the Jews from the Ukrainians, because when they found out that the Soviet troops are retreating, they basically holocausted them, and they were pretty happy that the Germans are coming, and the German officers actually saved a bunch of Jews from the...
May I add something why this happened? Because this is another story that is largely unknown. This was one of the largest terror attacks in history. The Soviets, they placed several bombs in the center of Kiev, enormous explosive devices. And they retreated, and when the Germans went in, they blew up the center of Kiev. It was an enormous explosion, and it killed thousands of Ukrainians. And the population of Kiev, they went furious, and they took out picks and pickaxes and shovels and all of that stuff like that, and they started to kill the Jews in the streets. beating them to death, because they gave them the responsibility for that. And Himmler himself gave an order that the SS had to stop the Ukrainians from killing the Jews.
Well, I've seen a few photos of the Ukrainians and the Jews, and everything you're telling us just makes us happy. That's fantastic. Wow, that is something.
I think it was, could it be Rundstedt, Eddie? General Rundstedt?
Maybe some of
German commanders were von Reichenau, Rundstedt, Guderian, von Kleist and von Mackensen.
Who was the commander of the army south?
I think at that time, Manstein.
Manstein? Could it be a Manstein? But no, I was laughing.
I don't think at that point. Maybe later.
Because he was very expressive and he said that basically one of his adjutants sent him a message and he said the Ukrainians are dancing, basically some of their national dances and singing and dancing, and in the they're dancing around a bunch of dead Jews in the middle of the street. What will do? So basically, most of the people are showing these Ukrainians that are co-opting the German troops. This is Kiev. This is Kiev, and I believe some are from Lviv. And let's remember that Lviv was part of the, maybe Kiev? No, Lviv was part of the Austro-Hungary until the end of the First World War. So basically they are more like, what was the German name of Lviv? I must check it out. But
Lemberg.
Lemberg. Yeah.
Yeah.
So basically, and you can, if you see the architecture is very close to the architecture, let's say, of Vienna.
Yeah.
So there was some cultural connection there. About the Jews, let's say that the largest pogroms in history are coming from Ukraine. Actually, the word pogrom is coming exactly from Ruthenian or Ukrainian. So,
wasn't there this, you know, Putin was referring to this contract from 1645 where the Ukrainians supposedly sworn oath to their loyalty to Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, there was this Cossack uprising where they basically, the Cossacks, I forgot the name of the Cossack leader, and he started a rebellion against the Polish occupation. Mm-hmm. And they killed a lot of Catholics.
Chmielnicki,
yeah. And also they killed like 30,000 Jews.
Yeah.
And this is still remembered by the Jews as one of the greatest pogroms in history.
The whole thing with the Jews and the Poles is that the Poles, they had these parliamentary, it's not even a parliamentary, it's basically oligarchic monarchy. Very strange with these basically big, powerful aristocrats and the king that was not so powerful. So it's not like the Kaiserreich that is quite hierarchical and centralized. It's like you have this oligarchy and the oligarchy is taking decision and you have a kind of figurehead, a monarch. And these oligarchs, they thought that the very efficient way to run the country, which is not basically to run the country properly, but to extort the country, is to send the Jews that they had to be tax collectors and to run some facilities. For example, how to put it? Whorehouses. Different I'm looking for a word right now. Basically, what's a bar? A pub? Not a pub. Whatever.
Yes.
Drinking.
Yes, drinking pub facilities. Or a bar, same thing. Yeah.
Something like that.
Like a beer hall or something?
Yeah, but they were not drinking beer. We're talking about 17th century in Ukraine. So basically the Jews were running these places, they're taking taxes and they are collecting the taxes for the the magnates, the Polish magnates. And basically the Ukrainians sent a letter to the Polish Senate, or whatever it's called, Rzeczpospolita. And they said, look, we are fighting for you. The Ukrainians actually were fighting on the side of the Poles for longer than for the Russian king. For a few hundred years, they were fighting on the side of the Poles against the Turks, against the Russians. And they said, we are fighting on your side, but you don't have the right of the Polish aristocrats. So they demanded the rights of a military aristocrat, which the magnate, which means that the magnates will not extort them. So the Polish magnates sent a big fuck you, and this started to cause problems. And of course the Jews were part of this oppressive regime of extortion of the Ukrainians, and that's why they didn't like the Jews and they didn't like the Poles. And that's why at some point the Ukrainians, and this was one big historical mistake, but back in the time it looked like a right decision, because a lot of the Ukrainians were Orthodox and they were using Kirillic and things like that. So they wrote a letter for support for the Tsar in Moscow that wanted to annex these ones. And there were a bunch of rebellions, counter-rebellions, rebellions against the Russians from the Ukrainians. The Poles were trying to take over Ukraine again. Ukraine is very rich land, and it's in very strategic position. Very strategic position. It's on the Black Sea, it's the Caucasus mountains, it's close to the Balkans, or the trading routes from the Middle East and from Africa across. But at the same time, the rivers are passing and you can connect with Northern Europe. It's very important. And I'm talking for hundreds of years before they found the gas and the oil and things like that. So Ukrainian land is both blessed and cursed. And what is going on right now, for example, in my vision, is continuation, geopolitically speaking. Geopolitically speaking, the clash of Europe and this Eurasian empire. And unfortunately, Europe is not prepared to fight. And I'm not talking so much about economy and technology, because Europe will have advantage in economy and technology. Mentally, Europe is not prepared to fight. And this is a big problem, I think.
You're talking about the near future.
Near future.
Yeah. Well, I think.
I think just to say two words. We predicted the war in Ukraine a few years before the war. We predicted that the Americans will play a double. Typical Anglo diplomacy. With one hand, they are giving a little bit of support, and on the other hand, they are preventing the defeat of the Russians. My predictions is that they are forcing Ukraine to sign some peace treaty that is in favor of Russia. And by favor of Russia means that Russia will use these 3-5 years to take over Ukraine at some point. Let's say that the peace treaty will be signed in.
Any kind of agreement with the Russians is in favor of the Russians.
Yeah.
But I think, I'm not interfering in the podcast, but I think this whole topic to predict the future and analyze the situation will maybe need another podcast.
Yeah, I was hoping to get to some of those things, but I think we need to organize another show and then we can carry on talking about some of these other topics. because I'd like to hear what you guys think. So thank you very much for the show, guys. It's been really nice talking to you, and we will definitely organize one in the coming weeks, and we'll get back to some of these topics. I want to hear more about Europe and the future.
Yeah, it would be very important, I think. And thanks for having me, and happy to join the show again.
Thank you, and have a victory.
Okay, guys, thank you very much.
Give up, my friend. If you don't see the end, if you don't see the top, don't stop. We know you'll win. Every fight you'll fight.